When is the last time you listened to a podcast about web development, web design, and small business and didn't fall asleep? Yes, we cover web development, web design, and small business, but like actual human beings with personalities. If you're a beginner, we're not going to talk over your head. It's more like asking your buddy for help. We have guests, we have fun, and let me tell you, these two can get off on a tangent. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to HTML All the Things Podcast. This is Matt Lawrence and Mike Curran.
That's right, everybody. We are back, and this is the HTML All the Things podcast. In this episode, we had the pleasure of sitting down with Kyle from TechSquid TV. He's a tech YouTuber. You've probably seen his videos on there. He's also a staff software engineer, and he was unfortunately recently laid off as of the recording of the interview with him, and we're going to have a discussion about that. So we're going to talk about all things sort of tech interviews and like what he likes. Does he like take-home interviews? What is he? How does he prep for interviews? All those type of things. Do you have to worry about those green GitHub squares? All that. And then we're also going to be talking about, you know, after a layoff, you know, like what happens? Or are you just done? It's like, well, the market's done. You know, we're all in trouble. There's layoffs. You know, are we completely, you know, woe is me, what's going on here? So we're going to be talking about that. And then we're going to also change gears to the end of the episode where we're going to be talking about, you know, a bit of hardware versus software and how to kind of get hardware and software working together. We're going to talk about some funny college stories that Mike and I had, as well as one of Kyle's really cool projects that he has been working on. And that's basically it. So let's just cut right to the interview because I know you've been waiting. Let's do that right now. All right, everybody, we have Kyle on the line here. And before we jump into this packed episode, Kyle, what's up? What's going on? What have you been up to?
Hey, how's it going, Matt? Kyle, aka TechSquid TV. You know, we're on the podcast because got laid off recently, but honestly, I see it as an opportunity. Been working on my website, some open source projects, and just having a little bit of fun in the meantime while working towards that next goal.
Yeah, that's great because, I mean, we kind of glad that we, I guess, caught you here, but not glad that you're in this situation. But we wanted to talk to you today about tech interviews because I know that a lot of our audience are new developers, junior developers, or people looking maybe to even job hop. And we thought, you know, this is a good time to talk about it because the market, job market in particular, is in a bit of a weird sort of spot, specifically in tech. Other areas are blooming, whatever. I'm not an economist, so who knows what the heck's going on. Hopefully they do. But I thought we'd kind of have a discussion on some technical interviews and maybe how to bounce back after a layoff. So let's just jump right in here. So for those listening that haven't had an interview for a job yet, so they're probably practicing, studying, doing all that sort of thing to prepare themselves for a job in web development. In general, what should they expect from interviews? Multiple interview rounds, just a technical interview, like a whiteboard or something like that, take home assignments. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it matters a lot depending on the size of the company and what you're actually applying for, but it's no secret that a lot of the engineering roles out there these days, especially these days, are going through a lot of rounds of interviews. There's a chance, I mean, there's definitely a sentiment that a lot of people believe that companies are maybe taking advantage of the fact that there are so many applicants out there. There is a little bit of extra time to kind of work through which candidates are, you know, more appropriate for the role. So it's not uncommon. I've been speaking to someone who I won't name the company, but just went through, I believe they said 8 rounds of interviews. I know at my last job, we actually had, I believe, 6 rounds. And that's on top of what might be either live coding sessions, lead coding sessions, or in my experience, my favorite version, if you're going to do one, a take-home exam.
So what do you think about like the take-home exam? Because I know that some people will, you know, sort of dread having to do tech right there, right on the whiteboard, or like they're dealing right with the interviewer, either on a call or in person. But then there's other people that sort of dread the take-home assignment because if you do all your interview stuff in the interview, you're good. Like you're done. There's no homework, right? But if you get a take-home assignment, the whoever's applying is more than likely applying to multiple roles. And now it's like, uh-oh, like are these homework assignments, these take-home assignments, are they all going to add up?
Yeah, that's a super valid point. And it matters too. Some of these companies are giving out assignments that a lot of us think are too long. It depends on what it is, right? I'll tell you, at my last company, we gave folks a fairly simple assignment that basically just showcased that you knew how to use the product. I think that it is beneficial because personally, I'm someone who doesn't operate the best under stress. You start asking me questions about JavaScript. I'm not using my IDE, my setup. You know, it's a very different and stressful environment. They'll say, you know, these different interviews, they have different purposes. People who are doing these live coding interviews with you, they may not necessarily be looking for the same things as the people who are sending you with the take home. A lot of the times when you're doing the live interview, it's a lot about the collaboration between you and the person who's live coding with you, right? It's not necessarily that you're coding and someone's watching. It's that you are pair programming together and how well do you work with each other. So if you try and keep that in mind, you can try to lower the stress of the situation. If you think about it less about you being analyzed and a little bit more about having an opportunity to work with someone else. But as someone with high anxiety myself, I totally understand wanting to take it home. The one thing I'll say with taking it home, you know, you got to balance. You don't want to spend too much time on it. It's not one of those things where, yeah, I can totally see how you could get overwhelmed. You have the opportunity to spend a lot of time on something. Therefore, you feel the need to. I'm not going to tell you not to put your all into it. It is an opportunity for you. And if you have a little extra time, I mean, I'd throw it out there, but that's totally up to you. You're going to have to balance what you have. But I will say kind of like two things. The major thing about getting to take it home is if you do want to put in a little effort into researching and putting the icing on the cake, that's all things you can do. You can talk to ChatGPT, you can learn some things, you can do all these types of things that you wouldn't do necessarily in the live interview. But here is the gotcha, and something that I definitely had seen when interviewing folks in the past, is it's not uncommon when I would see people take take-home tests and they would either copy and paste something directly from the documentation or possibly use a response that came directly from ChatGPT. And that might help you get through a certain stage of the interview. But once it comes time to review that code, I mean, speaking from the other side of the coin here, you know, interviewing folks, you know, we would go through things and we'd say like, okay, you know, I see you made this choice in your code. Can you explain a little bit about like, you know, what drove you to make that decision, or, you know, why do you think we should do this? And you want to definitely be able to answer those questions. So definitely, you know, don't rush through in the sense of just getting the task completed. It is there to kind of gauge your knowledge. And I do think that you're going to be tested on it, whether it's live or after the fact. So either way, you just got to be conscious that you're absorbing the information and not just regurgitating something you see online.
So something that I thought about with the take-home tests and take-home coding examples, a lot of times you'll give like a, hey, this is supposed to take like, you know, 2 to 5 hours or 1 to 3 hours, whatever you want to do. What would you say to people that are like, well, it's probably going to take me like 18 hours. Is that the skill level that they're asking for from me? So maybe I shouldn't proceed further, or should I try to do it in that 18 hours, give it my best, and go through with it? It's always like a really tough balance for me, like when I'm recommending these kinds of things, because like usually you're applying to like 15 different jobs at once, a bunch of them. So you have to kind of pick and choose your battles. But I'm curious your take on like assessing your own skill level based on the take home and not proceeding with further an interview just to save time.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think maybe a little bit later too, we'll talk about maybe in some cases it may be a good idea to be selective in the job interview process, but we can get back into that. When they are designating that this should take X to Y hours, I'll tell you from their point of view, that is actually what they're thinking. You know, someone of the skill level that we are expecting would probably complete this task in this amount of time. And they're using that gauge to kind of decide how long, you know, we don't want people to spend 18 hours on this. That's not the goal. But we want to try and find something that gives a technical task that can evaluate what they're looking for. Now, if you know you're going to come through and say, you know, that would take me significantly longer, I don't think that should discourage you, but you do need to factor that into whether or not you're going to proceed and whether or not you feel comfortable moving forward. Now, I'll tell you, when I worked at my last company, it was 6 years ago, I got hired, just over 6 years ago. And before that, I worked in retail. So this was my first real tech job. I don't remember at all what they said the take-home exam was supposed to take, but I'll tell you, I spent an enormous amount of time on it. It was one of the most frustrating moments of my life. They were asking me to test code. I didn't even know you could test code. That was a concept. I was like, what? You write code to to test other code? How does that even make sense? And then, you know, they're telling me you got to set up the CI/CD pipeline. I'm like, what is a CI/CD pipeline? And it was horrendous. I mean, it was literally the most stressful things in my life. But I got through it somehow. It came out the other side. I'll tell you, I didn't even pass the test necessarily. I mean, there was significant missing elements, right? Like in this particular test, they wanted me to set up a CI/CD pipeline that tested an application. And that was it, just test an application. And you might be thinking like, whoa, you had to write a whole application. Not necessarily. It could have just been a button or something like that. That's not how my brain was working, but hopefully that helps someone else. And I actually couldn't get the test to pass, but I'll tell you, when I went through the interview and we were doing a review of my take-home exam, the interviewer went and pair coded with me and tried to resolve the issue with me, and they couldn't do it either. So I think what happened was we kind of lucked out that we were both a little stumped on what was happening. But just to throw it in there, you know, I spent a lot of extra time on that particular take-home exam because I had a referral. I don't know that I can say that I would just do that all the time. It felt like it was a worthy investment. It felt like it was going to significantly improve my chances to spend a lot, you know, extra time on it. And I did keep in my mind, you know, do I have enough skill for this position? And the answer was probably no. But I knew that it was going to be a lot of work ahead. And I said, I'm ready for it. Let's, you know, let's do it. And it was a really rough few months, I'll tell you. I don't know that I would recommend, you know, all the stress that I put on myself, but it depends on where you're at and your education, your job search, all types of things. And there's so many things you don't know until you run into them.
Well, one way you can kind of hopefully de-stress yourself is preparing. And I'm sure there's a lot of people listening right now that are thinking, okay, you know, maybe I should be studying a bunch or doing whatever. And they're writing down, you know, CI/CD pipelines and the other things that you said there. So with that being said, you know, how far should somebody prep for a technical interview? So not the take-home exam, but before it, should you be doing, I don't know, projects? Should you be doing research on other people's interviews specifically? Like, what do you recommend for that?
Totally. And again, I'm going to be one of those people that just keeps saying it depends, but I promise it comes with qualifiers. It does depend on like the type of role you're looking for. And I want to say, you know, if you're dead set, let's just say I want to be a front-end web developer, right? That is the title you want. Your path forward should be fairly linear and well understood. What you need to learn is React, right? Most front-end jobs are going to be based in React. That doesn't mean you can't learn Angular. It doesn't mean you can't learn any of these other frameworks, but realistically, the most popular language out there for hiring today is going to be React. I would recommend spending some time on that. Now, let's just say language agnostic, beyond all of that, working on projects is a great idea. Working on projects is a great idea for so many reasons. And I don't mean building a calculator or something like that, right? What you want to do is you want to build a full application. You want to try and bring that application as far down the development cycle as you can. If you can add tests, you want to add tests. If you can add a CI/CD pipeline, you want to do that. If you can add the contributor docs, you want to do that. What you want to try and do is build up something that shows a level of, I'm going to say, professionalism around it, and shows your ability to not only write the code, but manage the repository. Here's the real fact. No matter who you're interviewing with, everyone likes numbers and graphs, people. So if you can get a lot of, you know, stars on that GitHub repo, even if you can say like, here's how many pull requests we've merged, here's how many releases we've done, there's a lot of numbers you can point to. If you're writing an NPM package or something like that, you can go on NPM and check out the number of downloads per week you get. There's all types of websites that can give you all types of stats on packages and things like that. So what you're doing for yourself is multifaceted. One, you're generating statistics that people love to see when they're doing the hiring process, that really gives them something quantifiable to say, like, yes, this candidate is able to produce this. And what you're doing for yourself is you're giving yourself a real life environment to kind of seat yourself in. It's not, if you're working on a true open source application, there is zero difference between working on that versus working on what some company is going to pay you, whether or not it's open source. You're working with people, you're interacting with pull requests and issues, you're gaining experience, you're fixing bugs. It's all exactly the same work. So if there's something that you can work on as a in your spare time, if that's something that you are capable of doing, have the time to do, so on and so forth, I by far mostly recommend that.
I think that's a very good point, because a lot of the stuff that we talked about, like the CI/CD pipeline, working with people, like having any sort of like team environment, is so foreign to some people if they've just been sort of studying alone, if they've just been reading guides, spinning up their skills, they're using React, whatever. Like Mike and I, we were working in a bubble. Like I know we were working together, so there's teamwork there. But when we first started, we've mentioned it like a million times on the show that we didn't use Git or any sort of version control. We used OneDrive. And we used like a OneDrive business account and like synced the OneDrive and like figured out who was in what file when and stuff like that. Not even thinking that there was really version control right at the beginning, right? Because we're just spinning up some basic websites. It's just vanilla HTML, CSS. And you don't think about that stuff at that point. So kind of getting into that team environment does show the teamwork, but then also shows you tools that you wouldn't even think of. Like CI/CD, at least for me, like I know what that is, but like even I don't use that right now, right? Because I do a lot of projects just solo, but at least I know what that is, and I can see so many people or like imagine so many people listening to this just not even knowing what that is without being exposed to it. So something like working on an open source project or starting a GitHub repo that you know is open for other people to contribute to is definitely a good idea.
Yeah, it's one of those things too. You don't know what you don't know, right? You have to be exposed to it. I think a really good example is I write a lot of Node.js. I don't even write most, you know, CI/CD on my own projects. Most of the time they're too small and I'm not that interested in it. But I'll throw out there too, it's also a factor of exposure. That was Node.js in particular. I also write Go, for instance. And with Node, if I want to publish or share what I'm doing, you don't necessarily need a CI/CD pipeline. Like we can go into that, but like, let's say it's a website that's going to Netlify or something. That's just push buttons, right? Like, yeah, there's a CI pipeline involved, but you don't have to think about it. You don't have to do anything like that. There's a lot of different options for sharing things written in Node, but if you're writing a Go application, it has to be compiled, it has to be written, you know, compiled to a correct operating system if you want to give it to multiple people. So I wrote a CLI recently. I have a website, ultimatehomeserver.com, just a little plug there. But there's a CLI for that. And, I want people to use it. And if you're writing Go on your computer, you can write Go run, just like you can run something in Node, but that's not how Go binaries are distributed. You need an exe for Windows. You need all your binaries for all your different platforms. And the easiest way to do that is to set up a CI/CD pipeline. You can use for instance, Go releaser is really popular on GitHub Actions. And that'll get you involved in CI/CD right off the bat, right? Like you don't actually have to know much about CI/CD or even testing, but if you're writing Go and you want it to build for multiple people, you can see how this path will bring you there. So just, you know, pick a project, a language, it doesn't matter, whatever you're doing, and just bring it to, you don't have to complete it. No project of mine has ever been completed, I don't think. But you gain the experience along the way, right? So take it as far as you can, as far as you care to, and learn what you can.
Absolutely. And I think like this actually leads well into, you know, you're saying no project of yours has ever been completed, and, you know, kind of expose yourself to those different technologies. And a lot of people out there are going to be thinking, I'm going to have like a full set of green squares on my GitHub. You know, this sounds like I'm going to need to study all these things, contribute to all these open source things. What happens if my GitHub isn't active? Like, what do I do? And Mike and I had this problem originally, like not back in the OneDrive days, but back when we actually knew what was going on, basically. But it was because we were working on, you know, NDA'd projects that A, weren't on GitHub. They were on GitLab. They were on the Bitbucket. They were on a bunch of different things. But then they were also just things that just weren't on GitHub. Some stuff was just like little one-offs. Like I'll do a lot of little one-offs. I'll show up, fix somebody's, you know, no code project with a bit of custom code, then I'll leave. There's no GitHub repo or anything for that. So, I mean, just logistically speaking, you know, how do you handle that with an interview? Like if the listener is putting in all this effort, trying all these things, the CI/CD, exposing themselves, trying Go, trying whatever else, but their GitHub is barren. Like, is that an end all be all? Like, how do they explain that to prospective employers? Or is this something that they need to remedy, do you think, right away?
Yeah, really, really good point. It's one of those things where it probably shouldn't, you know, be a detriment to anyone because of the extremely valid points you brought up. And I'll come back into that. But there is a bit of a visual component that's unfortunate. It's no one's fault. It's no one, you know, it's just an unfortunate reality that if someone is just browsing your GitHub repo too quickly and they're not considering these types of things and you haven't had the opportunity to speak to them or anything like that, they're going to make assumptions, right? It's the cover book situation. And that's just unfortunate. I don't, you know, I'm sorry that is the way it is, but, we want to try and keep up appearances. However, No, it is not an end-all be-all. And a lot of people fully understand your stuff is on GitLab, your stuff was on Bitbucket, your stuff is private. There's lots of things like that. The only thing that I have a problem with there is you have to have the opportunity to explain that.
Right.
Or you have to have someone who fully understands that. And your work history may pretty much allude to that anyway. If you have like 10 years of experience and not a lot of squares, no one's thinking this person's a liar. People are thinking, right, you know, it's somewhere else. But that's why it's important to keep up appearances. So I'm going to say that in like two different ways. Quick sidetrack. First of all, keep good detailed notes of what you're doing. And I don't mean, you don't have to like, you know, right, this is the exact project I did for this company. It's secret. If anyone finds these notes, I'm going to be in trouble. What I mean is you can abstractly talk about things you have learned. In fact, I highly recommend setting up a blog for this. It doesn't need to be popular. It doesn't need to be fancy. It doesn't need to be anything. You can go get a free template. You could do Hugo for static site generation. I have an Astro site. I'm a big fan of Astro. And that can be a project too, by the way. I highly recommend your own website is a very valid project. But then what you want to do is take any of the learning experiences that you come across, even if it's abstractly, you don't need to name specific things, and you want to write about your experiences and the problems you've overcome. And you'll notice, I'm sure anyone who's listening who's done on a question that sounds something like, tell me about a time that you ran into a problem and had to solve it, yada, 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 right? If you have a blog full of those experiences over the past, you know, several years, not only can you share those experiences directly, but that's good notes for you, right? That's information for you to go back and say, okay, you know, I'm working on this interview and they're asking me these questions about things I've done in the past. And I can't necessarily point to code, or I don't even have access to that code anymore. I can't even look it up because I've left that company 3 years ago and it wasn't public. So you having a catalog of knowledge, a blog is my way of doing that, is going to be extremely helpful for you getting around answering some of those questions and keeping the knowledge fresh yourself. That said, that is just the one half. If you have the ability, and I'm stressing have the ability, if you can have one or two semi-decent projects on your GitHub and just keep those ones active, something to put in the pin section, that would be ideal. It's not going to be possible for everyone. And that's fine. If your code, let's just say like on the rare instance, if you have a, let's say like a more popular repo and it's on GitLab, but you're worried that people are not seeing it on GitHub, there's multiple answers there too. First of all, you can just do a mirror. So you can actually mirror an entire repository from GitLab to GitHub. You can also just do something like, it's not uncommon for folks to use GitHub. I'm not a huge fan of this, to be honest, but it's not uncommon for folks to use GitHub as a place to manage just like issues, but not keep the source code there, right?
Right.
So you could keep a repository that is in reference to something you've worked on, but does not actually contain any code or anything like that. That, again, that's where I would just use blog posts, but that's another technique that some people use.
It's an interesting problem. And I think it also goes back to like when you're applying for jobs. So getting in the interview, that means you've already made that step and you can probably explain it away, especially if you've, you know, if you have the proof. But with someone that's just applying and someone that's new and doesn't have that experience, it's one of those things where you just have to kind of bite the bullet, right? Like no matter what, like when you're going through a job description, they're like, we're going to look at your GitHub, or like the application has a GitHub slot in it, which is pretty common. If you have an empty GitHub, you might not get the interview. And that's like their first goal of anything when you're trying to get into tech or anything like that. You need to get the interview. So you need to do whatever you can. I'm not saying game the system, but you know, do whatever you can to, you know, figure out all the little steps that could block you from that next step.
I will say just to rebut that, and like we can kind of debate, is that having gone through, and I'm sure we all have in school, a million and one career classes. And then, you know, they'll teach you, this is how you do the resume, this is how you do this, 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 blah, blah, blah. And it's general information. It's not for tech jobs because, you know, you're in a general classroom, like a high school classroom or something. But then there's always like that section, or at least I always had that section of the class where they're like, yeah, but by the way, even if you do all these steps, these 10-step, 15-step process, and you do it perfectly, somebody will sometimes just, you know, basically an HR person will take a stack of resumes and they will have a piece of criteria that is just nonsense to just thin the pack. So it'll be like, oh, you don't live in a city, you're out, you know, for no other reason other than I have 10,000, you know, applicants here and I need to get rid of 8,000 of them so that I can go to the tech department and then like further, you know, sort of filter this list. And so this is a rudimentary random thing. And so the GitHub thing is a little more close knit, like with web development and with developing anything in general, of course, obviously, like it absolutely, like if you really want to work for a company and they really want a GitHub, then maybe, you know, you probably should get on that. But I'm scared to like get people scared, right? Because they might be like, well, I did all these things and like I put all this work into this GitHub, or I put all these work into these like little rudimentary things, and like I didn't get the interview. Why? And it's like, oh, well, your name may have started with A. It really could be like that.
Yeah. No, it is like that. I'm going to tell you a real story. Well, I was trying to decide how much I should say and how much I shouldn't, but we're already here. So there we go. We're hiring for a position that requires someone with Docker experience, and that's handed off to a recruiter. And remember, recruiters are typically not, you might have a technical recruiter, but they're not, you know, an engineer typically, right? So we ran into a situation where we found out that someone had been rejected because their resume had mentioned that they had Kubernetes experience, but did not mention that they had Docker experience. These are the types of things that are like, that's just silly. And that's not, you know, that's much less arbitrary too. It's just that they were looking for, you know, we told them we want Docker experience. We didn't say Kubernetes, that's on us. That was another level up. And someone who didn't think to add that keyword could miss out. So I'm going to say, you know, and I don't know if we will get into that, but I typically do not apply to jobs directly. And this is much harder to do when you're new in the industry, but not impossible. And I can come back to that too. But applying directly is almost a lost cause. It's not that it's entirely impossible, but you're going to be spending a lot of time fighting an automatic system or fighting arbitrary cuts and things like that you're mentioning. So we were talking about keeping up appearances earlier. I mean, a lot of that, and this goes hand in hand with networking, is to try and circumvent some of those early cuts, some of those early systems that can pull you out of the pool. And I really mean getting referrals. And you might be thinking, how am I supposed to get a referral if I'm new to tech and all of that? We can start a whole conversation there. I won't dive in at the moment, but having that public presence, having a blog, having a YouTube or something like that, it doesn't have to be all that flashy, but having somewhere that can prove what you can do and then showing that to people, networking with people, can get people excited for you, about you, things like that, right? It's a little bit different for me, but I've been posting a lot on LinkedIn recently since I got laid off, and I've been putting a lot more effort into posting on LinkedIn than I have been applying places. And that has resulted in more than one person reaching out to me directly just because of posts on LinkedIn. Now I'm a little lucky because I'm coming from a tech position previously. I also have people who are, you know, in my network trying to help me find positions and things like that too. So it's great. But it's a real hard battle to fight that first round or those automated systems and things like that. And I would recommend putting as much of your time as possible into trying to circumvent that process so that you don't have to worry about some of those more arbitrary systems.
So right now at this very stage in the you know, job market for tech jobs, putting your resume into a pile / just applying online to like a position on Indeed or LinkedIn, I don't want to say it's hopeless, but from my understanding, a lot of those positions are just open all the time, and they're there for visibility for the company. They're there for the recruiting agencies. They're there for X and Y reason. They're not there to hire the best candidate. Not all of them. There's obviously some real ones. It's still worth applying, in my opinion. Just like Kyle said, try to spend more time getting around the applications rather than just grinding the application mill. Another story, like not a personal story, but something I saw online and I saw happen in real time. I think Unkey, the developer James Perkins there, posted a position. He's not a very big account, couple thousand followers. The position was posted on an account on Twitter with a couple thousand followers. For front end, full stack dev, whatever, for web development, they got 1,000 applications off of Twitter in 24 hours.
Whew. Incredible.
Yeah, like it's 99% of those applications are impossible to go through. Like as soon as you get 1,000, you're like, okay, this way of finding someone isn't working. So you're not even going to go through those applications. That's the reality. If you're a one person team or like a small company, you don't have a recruitment agency that you can hire out so they can do that random thing that Matt was saying, where they just, you know, throw out half your resumes and all that. Like
which you can understand why they would have to when you're faced with 1,000 applications. Yeah.
Yeah. And it grew to 2,400 in 7 days. So like, and then they turned it off. Like, so it's just that I'm not trying to say this for it to be hopeless. I'm trying to push Kyle's point on you have to find ways around it. And there are plenty of ways around it. And I'll let, like, we'll discuss it, I think, soon. But that's the reality of the situation we're in right now. It might change. So if you're listening to this 6 months from now or a year from now, this might not be the situation. And I would recommend to do some extra research, listen to some newer podcasts that are talking about the same thing. Maybe there's a new way to apply. Maybe the, you know, Indeed is back up and all that, and it's fine. But that's the situation right now.
Yeah, I think we should also mention too, just because I think we're all probably looking through the lens of remote work. I'm not sure if that's the same for y'all, but I'm looking for remote work, and that's why, you know, I think you're going to get those thousands of applicants on Twitter, and that makes it harder too, right? You know, when you're applying to a remote position, you are intrinsically up against more competition. That is just how it works. So, you know, remote work is great for me. I recommend it, but it's not great for everyone. So that might not even be something you want. I would just think about that too. And depending on where you live, because that's a huge part of it. I was from Southern New Jersey originally. There's no tech work there. You can't, you know, it was remote or bust for me. So you got to see what you can work with. But if you have the opportunity to work locally, especially if you're a newer dev trying to like get into the market, you can help a lot. You know, I still recommend, and we should still talk about, you know, getting referrals and getting around the everything in the first rounds. But if you can apply locally, you are automatically working with less competition, which is a great help if you're just trying to get into the industry as well.
That is a really good point, because I mean, it almost echoes, we've had, you know, obviously a look at the job market in the past, like recently in a few episodes. And one of the things that we had mentioned, at least at the beginning of this sort of technical job apocalypse, if you want to coin it with something, is that a lot of people are looking for tech jobs in tech companies, and that there's a lot of other businesses like random accountants or like whatever that need a web developer or a developer of some sort to help them sort through records, you know, do different things like that. And some of those businesses, you know, to sort of take it to your point, is that some of those businesses might be local. Some of those businesses might be, they're taking out newspaper ads, and they're just down the road from your, you know, from your house. And you can literally walk down there and work there every day. And you're helping to have Python scripts to rip through tax documents or something like that. Like, who knows? So there is like a different, like, remote work, and then obviously like working in tech at a tech company. There's like these layers and layers and layers to this thing where, you know, you can dig deep and hopefully possibly, you know, find something. Cause there might be even people out there that don't, I almost guarantee this. There's going to be people out there that don't even know that they need a developer. They're literally saying like, I need someone to help me sort through records on a computer. Really? You know, and then, cause they're an accountant or they're a, you know, whatever, a inventory specialist. They don't know what's going on. And then you're like, well, I could do this with a script. It's like, okay, what's a script? And then that's how you get in. So there's like different ways, if you kind of peel back those layers, it's not always this hopeless, like, toss it into the lottery that is the pile of interviews, like Mike said. And then it's not always like, hey, I need remote work. I need to like, you know, find a tech company, or I need to like, you know, go on social media. It could be local. And that's one area that that's actually really important, that some people can like really, really dig into.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, you know, your point about tech in non-tech companies too. A lot of people don't realize that, like, you know, McDonald's is a huge tech corporation. Like, mm-hmm. every tech job you can think of is available at McDonald's. You know, I just found out the other day, I don't know why this is surprising to me, but Walmart has its own data center. You know, and these might be obvious, but and another, you know, again, this example works a little better for me, but when I was originally trying to, you know, find work, and that wasn't happening for me in New Jersey, I moved to Philadelphia. That's where I'm at now. And I'll just say, you know, being in a city, there's a ton of local work if that's what you're looking for. I mean, especially in my city in Philadelphia, we just have a ton of medical and financial companies. So if you want to, you know, be a software engineer for some health insurance company or any other type of financial company, there's tons of it here. I'm sure a lot of it's probably remote as well. But it's a huge factor that a lot of people don't think of. Hospitals have huge, you know, tech sections as well. I will say, I know I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to provide any value here, but I remember the struggle of trying to find tech jobs when I was new to the industry slash in a more rural area. A lot of it was really just IT, not really tech. So like that is a struggle. And it was really hard for me to get around that. Really, I couldn't get around it, to be quite honest. I tried very difficult. I thought I was going to be in IT for a while. I'm not saying it's the worst stepping stone either. So like it's better to be in IT than working at, you know, a retail position, right? If you're trying to get into software, it's totally fine. It's also important to understand that getting your foot in a door at a company can lead to you moving internally at that company a lot easier as well. I'll use an interesting example. My last job 6 years ago was at Geek Squad in Best Buy, if you're in the US, if you're familiar. And kind of interesting I really give them props for this. I would just worked at a store and, you know, would fix laptops, but I had connections to and the ability to talk to people all the way up the chain in the company. And there was lots of positions for like web developers and all types of tech related things at the corporate level of Geek Squad and Best Buy, right? So I spent a lot of time when I was doing my retail job, kind of like we had internal forums where we could talk about things, they would post updates. I would use that opportunity to learn and kind of build connections with those people too. And for a while, I thought that was where I was going to end up. And I wouldn't mind going back there today, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I guess I think like the main message like that we're kind of, you know, unveiling and sort of presenting here is that there's, you know, really opportunities everywhere. You don't have to go after the sort of like, you know, the number one or the top way to try to find a job. There's like little place, you know, little opportunities anywhere. And you mentioning IT reminded me of at my first job at BlackBerry, I was IT desktop, but we used to talk constantly to our tech leads. And at that time, like our tech leads were really like they were programmers plus IT. They were writing our tools to fix computers. They were writing our tools to distribute operating systems throughout the company. They were doing a lot of, you know, Python scripts and web development because we had web portals that would connect to the ticket software to make it easier for us, like on an actual BlackBerry at the time, to like actually manage tickets on a very small screen at the time, of course, right back then, all phones had small screens. And it's like they were really, you know, coding. I don't know what the percentage of time it was of their job, but it was certainly a lot. Because we were the boots on the ground running around, you know, fixing the monitors and the TVs and everything else. And they were there building the tools to support us. And so, like, even though it says IT on the ticket, there might be, you know, once you get into the company and have a discussion, there might be a fair bit, if not a majority of it, is, you know, solutions finding. And those solutions may be custom tools because companies don't want to use all these cloud tools all the time, or they have such a specific thing they need internally. That it's like, I'm not going to, you know, buy a software and then use one of 700 features. Like that's, you know, that's lunacy. I'll just hire someone to make that tool and maintain it for a couple of years or whatever. So.
Yeah, it's a dream job. I mean, it did not pay well, but one of my earlier jobs was kind of like this. It was being the IT guy for a small office. And then, you know, because I could, I just wrote a little bit of software for them and it worked out and it was great. And I threw it on the resume. Why not?
Yeah, why not? Absolutely. Yeah. So I would like to flip the coin here a bit. So we're talking a lot about, you know, vetting, or like, I guess the jobs themselves, the employers, prospective employers sort of vetting us, the applicants, if you will. But, you know, some tech companies, we've already covered this, you know, they'll perform multiple rounds of interviews. They'll have, you know, HR interviews, then technical interviews. Some of them will even put you in sort of a testing center, I've heard. And then everyone will sort of write an exam, almost like a midterm in college or something like that. So with all that, you know, having been said, is there anything that you should be doing on your end? So you, the applicant, should you be vetting and maybe even limiting what you're doing? So I have a couple of questions and a couple of things I want to talk about in there. And the first one is, with so many rounds of interviews for many companies, does it make sense for you to apply to a limited amount of companies? Because you don't want to have too much prep to do, too many at-home assignments, too many like, oh, wait, I have two interviews on Tuesday. Hopefully that exam gets finished quickly. Like kind of gets a bit disaster. So do you go for quality of interview, meaning you know, you're well rested, you're well prepped, or do you go for quantity of your interviews?
Yeah, all really good questions. And I'm going to have to say it depends again. But I mean, truly, I'll tell you what I want it to be and then just the reality of, you know, what your situation might be. I mentioned earlier, you know, I'm being selective and I'm in a position where I'm laid off. I have a little bit of severance. I was saving up some money. wanted to buy a house, but we all know how the housing market is. So, you know, if I want to take a little bit of extra time personally to find the quality, we'll say, that's the approach I'm taking, because I want to, I have a certain, a certain number in my head for what I want to be paid. I know that I want to be happy at where I'm going to be. And I believe that I have a little bit of a, you know, a hand here with my previous experience and such, where I might be able to have that luxury. Now, that being said, if you need a paycheck in a few weeks, ignore everything I just said. That's completely irrelevant and did not help you at all. So I totally understand. And in that case, you know, what I would recommend is, you know, first of all, don't forget to, you know, just because you got hired somewhere does not mean you can't, you know, say, oh, I found a better offer even a few weeks later. That happens. It's fine. You don't even have to put that company on your resume. It's fine. You know, you can do that. For some people, though, I do think, and I hope this is the strong minority, but, you know, I do think a lot of people just apply to so many things. They don't even know what they applied to. They just applied to, like, oh, I applied to 40, 50 places today. I'm going to apply to 40 or 50 places tomorrow. I have spreadsheets. That's not for me. You know, that might work out, but I have a hard time believing that you genuinely want to work at all of those places, or that all of those places genuinely offer the salary or benefits you're looking for. And again, I don't know where you're at on your scale. But I would try to, you're going to have to strike a little bit of a balance, but, you know, apply to and put your all into the places you want to be, the places that are going to offer you what you're looking for, when applicable. If you got to get paid, you got to get paid, and there's no shame there.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's almost like crunch time. Like, we talk about crunch time in the development world. It's like, are you on crunch time? Do you have a payment coming up, a bill payment coming up? Do you need something, you know, whether it's tech adjacent or whether it's like you're going to be filling potholes for the town that you live in? Like, who knows, right? Like, do you need, you know, what are you going to do? And at that point, it's sort of like, okay, I'm just going to apply everywhere, scattershot it. Maybe that's your strategy. But again, like, it's up to everyone's strategy, up to everyone's different sort of position in life, for sure. But is there anything that you think sort of is a red flag that pretty much anyone should avoid? And obviously we're talking in general, so like, this isn't necessarily like, you know, written in stone by any way, but, you know, is doing too many interview rounds a form of red flag, and like, applicants should be like, man, I keep hearing it, like, these guys are doing 15 rounds, like, I'm out of here. Is there anything else, like, obviously low salary, or the position's been up for like 2 years or something ridiculous on a job board? Like, what are some just sort of common red flags that some people could just say, okay, strike this off the list, like, even if I'm scattershotting, I'm not gonna touch these?
Yeah, great one. I'll tell you, I mean, I'm not a big fan of the multi-interview things, and it can be a lot, but I will say typically, not always, but typically the places that have a lot of interviews, typically they pay a lot. That's part of their whole strategy of kind of like knocking out some of the folks who maybe wouldn't be a great fit there. So if that's something that you can, you know, brute force your way through, and it's what you want, I think that's great. But putting that aside, let me say, like, some things I'll do when applying to a company, I never just apply, right? Like, first of all, I'm doing some research on that company. I want to know a few things. And as someone who has been through layoffs, it's top of mind. And job security is a weird thing these days. I wouldn't say anyone is job security, just throw that out there. I mean, job security as a concept might not even really be relevant in terms of speech anymore. But something I'd be looking at is, you know, you have a range of different companies you can apply to. Some of these are going to be really early startups. Some of these are going to be public companies with tons and tons of money, right? I'll use Microsoft as just an example because they're so big. But if they're public like Microsoft and you are getting stocks as part of your equity, that's a great benefit to have. And also you're not worried. Microsoft's not going out of business. That's not happening. There's no chance of anything like that happening. Microsoft's not going to get purchased. You know, it's purely stable versus, you know, I was having a conversation with a company the other day that's in their Series A. They just did a seed and now they're in Series A. They have $10 million. That's great. The biggest investor is the CEO himself. Maybe a red flag. Not saying it's bad at all. In fact, I think it's what they're doing is kind of cool. But you have to recognize that they are in a financial situation that is a lot less stable than some of these other folks, and they may be more prone to things like layoffs or you know, possibly getting purchased or shut down or things like that. They may not offer stocks. They may offer options or things like that, which is, we could go into that, but it's not the same. And you know, these are things you're going to have to weigh in together. Another thing that I think people skip over, something that I'm going through right now, you want to take a look at like health benefits too, which is normally not listed on these applicants. So it's, if you get into the interview, it's something you can ask about. But some companies out there, for instance, provide full benefits paid for, right? Like nothing comes out of your paycheck. That was actually something that I got at my last job, really great. And now it makes it a little hard to do the math when you're trying to figure out what you want to get at your next job. So you want to get an idea of what your full comp is going to be. Make sure you understand that. And then make sure you understand like what is the base comp, what additional comp is coming through as benefits, and what are those benefits and things. And just make sure you actually understand what it is you're being paid.
It's a very good point, because I mean, if the, you know, the health insurance is covering, you know, something that you need and it's going to save you $300 a month. I mean, if they're taking, if you're like, man, the salary is just a little too low. It's like, well, it kind of isn't, because like I'm saving this much. It's almost like a coupon code, I guess, for life in a way. So yeah, no, absolutely. That absolutely makes sense. Now, obviously this episode has been, you know, sort of brought on by the fact that, you know, the job industry, as we said, the tech job industry is, you know, not in the greatest position right now. There's a bit of a tech recession, I've heard people call it. Whether it's actually that, again, I'll leave that to the economists. But many, many developers, web and otherwise, and other tech workers, of course, have sadly been affected by the tech layoffs that have been rippling through various industries. So, with that being said, do you have any advice for people that are currently learning development and haven't worked in the field yet? Should they stop due to the market conditions? This is something that Mike and I have actually seen people ask, like, hey, I've been studying for a year. I haven't joined tech. You know, I'm still working as a mechanic or whatever they're doing. Now what? You know, now this thing that I was going toward that seemed like the utopia of jobs for me is falling apart. There's a big crack in it. What do we do?
I feel that so much. I feel you on that one. When I was first joining tech, it was one of those things where it's like, oh, if you work in tech, then Google's going to fly you out. They're going to have a dinner with you and do the interview and put you up in a hotel. And then you're going to get hired and make $1 million a year. You know, maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit, but the point was, it was this rock star solid idea. And I'll tell you, over the last 6 years, that was like, when I started, I would say that was still kind of the case, but not, it was like right at the very end of that. When I got hired, I went out to San Francisco, you know, met some folks, there was all types of fun stuff that we did. But things kind of started changing, right? We can leave it to the economists to figure out, you know, the specific reasons of why everything happened and so on. But I do think, this is my speculation, it's going to change, right? I do not think that software engineer is going to be that all-star, you know, job that pays a ton of money and makes you feel like a rock star kind of scenario. I think that might be over. It's a more mundane job now, right? Where it used to be kind of like a specialized thing. Now it's still specialized, don't get me wrong, but it is a more common position. And I think that's becoming a little bit recognized. So now, would I tell you to stop? Absolutely not. Would I tell you to stop if you're only doing it for the money? Yeah, maybe. I mean, if you get no enjoyment out of development and you're in this space because someone has told you this is what you need to do to become rich, you should probably stop. Only because you're not going to be happy. That's the only reason I'm saying you should probably stop if you're not going to be happy. If this is something that you're interested in, but you're worried about the future, I don't think that's something you have to worry about. We just have to be accepting of change, right? And I'll be honest, we're probably going to see some of the most rapid change in history in a job market for, in not just ours, but lots of things. I mean, AI, you know, no one really knows yet, but it's really easy to forget that AI is not that old. It's, you know, the type of advancements we've seen over the last year, pretty incredible, and they're not going to be stopping. And we're going to be adjusting with that. That might mean a few things. I would not be shocked if it meant that salaries are going to be getting a little bit lower. I wouldn't be shocked if that's why layoffs are happening a little bit. I wouldn't be shocked if I saw some articles mentioning layoffs are just more common. We'll have like more short bursts of, you know, companies hiring up and building out a product and then possibly scaling back more quickly. It might become a more infrequent thing like that. But that doesn't mean that you should stop. And when we were looking at, you know, alternatives out there, it's going to depend to you and what your skills are and what you enjoy in life. But it's still a really high paying position. It will still be a high paying position for the foreseeable future. If we're talking like 30 or 40 years, I have no idea. No one does. Anyone who says they do is completely lying. I can promise you for the next 10 years, There will be room to grow. The only thing is that I think is going to be important now, and it was always important, but it's going to be more important now, is actually two things: specializing and excelling, right? You need to not just be able to use these tools. You need to become a professional at these tools. You need to really show people how you can provide value, because you're competing with a lot of folks, especially in this remote world.
It's a super weird situation that we're in right now. And it's super exciting and super scary at the same time with all the AI stuff for new developers. But I think for a lot of people, it should be seen as an opportunity. If you learn to use the tools as they're being developed, a lot of the old guard, a lot of the people that are ingrained into development right now, I've talked to some of them. Some of them are not using any of the AI tools because they think it's just like, you know, buzzwords and garbage and all that. If you come in and learn the AI tools, ChatGPT, OpenAI, APIs, Copilot, if you learn to take advantage of that as you're learning and as you're building, and it becomes ingrained, like it becomes part of your development process, I feel like that's when you could come in and like almost, you know, take some of the people that are refusing with the times, because there's going to be people that are not going to want to learn this stuff. And that's okay. Like it's not for everyone, but the reality is, like Kyle said, this stuff's coming and it's getting better and it's going to make us way more productive. Like right now, it's already making me way more productive. We're just on the show, like before the show started, Kyle and I were talking about it. I couldn't live without Copilot today. And it was like 2 years ago or like a year and a half ago that didn't even think that anything like that was possible. So embracing the tools as well as learning and like bringing them into your development lifestyle or development life cycle, that might differentiate you from some of the people that are in the industry right now. And I feel like I wonder what's going to happen. No one can predict the future, but I really wonder what's going to happen. Is it going to be a plethora of companies starting to be formed because all the really difficult stuff that couldn't be done before without, you know, 100 engineers can now be done with like 3? And so now we're seeing, instead of seeing like a massive monoliths growing, we're seeing a more horizontal plane of smaller companies taking over little things that were seemingly impossible and challenging the monoliths. Like that could lead to way more jobs is what I'm trying to say. And like, we don't know. And anyone predicting saying that you should stop right now is giving you bad advice. Because where are you going to go? Like every industry is going to have this impact. Some might say blue collar, might not, but like, if you're in the office space, if you're going away from blue collar because of health reasons, or you just want to have an office job, like there is no other option. You have to embrace it.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember playing with Markov chains just like 3 or 4 years ago. That was what we had. It was like random strings of text that was like maybe kind of looked like a sentence that a human could have written. And now we have, you know, I remember growing up, you know, so I have a YouTube channel, and I made YouTube videos for a number of years, multiple channels actually. And a lot of it was always built on like building tutorials for developers, because I always wanted, you know, more help learning how to develop. It was always a really complicated thing. It's always reading docs, reading really old blog posts and things like that. It was really, really difficult. And I tried to, you know, improve what was out there for folks by making YouTube videos. And I always just thought to myself, like, oh my God, this would be so much easier if I could just have a tutor or something like that. Right. And now we're at this point in life where for like $20 a month or free, and you know, depending on what you're looking at, you can have access to what is essentially a tutor. Are they as good as a human? Some people argue it's like, well, it's not as good as a human. It's like, yeah, well, how much does a human cost? You know? But I can get a lot of work done, you know, and maybe it takes a little longer. Maybe it takes a little bit more back and forth. Maybe it takes a little bit of tweaking, but what you can accomplish with the back and forth between AI is incredible. AI is teaching me Go, and has been for like the better part of a year. I would not have really touched Go without the help of ChatGPT to answer all the questions, to show me everything. It would have taken me 3 or 4 times longer.
I think the thing with that too is you can approach the AI. First of all, you can try different AIs, but you can also approach the AI in a different way. So like a teacher or a tutor, you know, might be more of a human touch, and some people may be more receptive to that as learners. But there's also, you know, the angle of like, oh, I didn't like that teacher. And maybe it wasn't due to like, you know, them yelling at you or something. It was just because the way they were teaching wasn't your style of learning and it didn't kind of work out. With AI, you can kind of say, hey, how do I do this? And then you can say, hey, expand on that. If you're more of an example driven learner, for example, right, you can go in and be like, hey, like, give me another example of that, or give me a piece of that code, or write me up this whole, you know, snippet here because the way I learn is I take a big old chunk and I break it and I play with it and I see what's going on. That's the way I do it. And you can get the AI to give you those different outputs. Whereas, you know, if a teacher kind of has a lesson plan or has experience teaching in a very particular way, they may not be flexible enough to do that. And so, you know, going through, like you said, hiring a tutor or a teacher in any way is going to be expensive, but then also hiring a tutor or a teacher, or rather going through multiple tutors or teachers, if you're like, oh, I don't like that tutor, I'll go to another one, is also time investment and money investment and everything else. So, you know, AI, you know, teaching us does, you know, absolutely help. And it's an interesting angle on that. So I would like to touch on, you know, obviously there's going to be a lot of people out there right now that have been in tech and as a developer, and they've unfortunately been, you know, let go. They've been let go due to layoff or due to a company shutdown or, you know, whatever else is happening. So I kind of want to touch on that for a moment. And it's just because, you know, it's kind of like the classic, I guess, you know, get back on the horse, you know, let's go, let's do whatever. And it's going to be discouraging for some. And so I want to talk about that, because should someone who's been in the industry for a while, you know, whether, let's say, like a year plus, should they be, you know, looking to get right back into it right away? Should they be, you know, looking to make any changes? Like, hey, you know what? This time I'm going to try to get a higher salary, or I'm going to try to get a more interesting job at an agency or at a business that I'm actually interested more in. Should I be upgrading my portfolio? Should I be doing a side hustle now to, like, give myself a safety blanket? Like, what do I do? There's a million questions, a million solutions and articles and blogs and blah, blah, blah out there. So to sort of kind of cut through the noise, you know, what would you suggest, Kyle?
Yeah, you know, when we started this, you asked like how I was doing and such, and I said, you know, I got laid off, but I see it as a little bit of an opportunity at the moment. And maybe that's a weirdly overly optimistic view at this point in time with the market, but again, I'm going to use that famous phrase, it depends. But it's an opportunity, assuming you have the leeway and time to sort yourself out and get together with what you want to do, right? Because I don't know about, you know, everyone listening, but me, myself, when I was, you know, working full time recently, I did not put a lot of time into my network or growing any of my, you know, a side gig or business or anything like that, or even learning so much, because I'm spending so much time working. Now, what I have right now, I'm going to call it a little bit of summer vacation. And it's just it's a time to kind of like regroup and process that information and decide what is important. And what I would say is, if it's a possibility for you to not get out there right away, I would consider it. It's a little risky. I'm going to throw that there, because we know what's going on in the market. We understand there's a lot of people applying to jobs. So like, if you know, if that's on your mind, I don't want to cause you any lack of sleep. But if you, you know, if you've been working for a long time, years, and you finally have a moment to like sit down and decide what it is that you want to do and what's important to you, it's not a bad opportunity to take that time. So I'll tell you, I mean, right off the bat, I'm planning on asking for more money. I understand, you know, how the market is, and there may be other people out there willing to take less, but this is your opportunity, right? If you were going to make more money, it was when you're going to switch between jobs. And there's always the opportunity to negotiate, right? Assuming you make it, you know, if you're wildly out of range, then there might be no opportunity to negotiate, but we'll see what it is. For me personally, it was a lot of thoughts. You know, I worked full time as a software engineer, staff software engineer. And before that, I did some YouTube, and I thought to myself, maybe we should do YouTube again. Thought about it a little bit longer and realized, no, you're going to make a lot, you know, you make a lot more money getting paid on a paycheck. However, I thought about it a little bit longer. I started having other ideas. And this is what the freedom of a little bit of time grants you, assuming you actually have that freedom. But I started thinking, you know, I've always wanted to make a video game. Do I want to make a video game? Thought about that for a little while and decided it's cool, but it's risky, and it's not for me right now. So that's what, you know, I got to think about it, decided I'm probably not going to do that one. I started thinking a little bit more. I was like, okay, you know, YouTube doesn't pay that much, at least the way I was doing it, the way that I have, you know, experience with things. However, talking to a few people on Twitter, talking to the network, seeing some things out there, people may not. Maybe, you know, maybe there'll be less people who want to sponsor my YouTube, but maybe I could provide my video creation services to other companies. Started doing some math, started to figure out, okay, how much would I charge? Let's break down how much I made per hour at my last job. And then, like, how long would it take me to create a video? How much could I charge? And how many videos would I need to make per year if I wanted to make my previous salary? Did the math, found that it's, you know, maybe I won't be able to do that much volume. Maybe I won't be able to get that many gigs right away, but I feel like I can actually get pretty close to what I made at my last salary if I start doing some side gig work. So again, because I have the time, I'm taking a little bit of time. If it doesn't work out, it's fine. I'll go back to, you know, I'm still applying to places. I have not stopped applying to places. I'm just being selective. And in my free time that is not spent applying to 35, 50 places a day, I'm working on building up the network. I'm working on talking to people. And I've already gotten a few conversations going with folks who are interested in video creation content. In fact, one of them, if they end up taking it, I probably don't have to worry about a job for 6 months. So it's definitely something just to, you know, slow down a little bit, analyze your situation, analyze how long you have, analyze the money you need to make, the benefits that are necessary, and then start planning like, okay, so what do I need to start making progress towards that goal? You know, if you're completely new in tech, like you haven't been laid off, you're gonna be hyper focused on your fundamentals and getting some position. Like I was in a support engineer, right? We talked earlier about like you could go into IT, you could go into whatever. You just want to get in on the ladder. If you were laid off, maybe take some of that time we were talking earlier, putting your achievements into documents and blog posts and things. And so, you know, something you can share with people and get that network going. And then when you have all of those materials, you can use that for better negotiating, and hopefully you can actually ask for more. And it's not going to be a scenario where we lost our jobs and we had to take a pay cut. I don't think that's necessary. I think we all have an opportunity to, you know, grow with this, but it matters on, you know, do you have runway or not?
Do you have any advice on building a network? I know a lot of people, like, we try to give as much advice on this as possible because we know the power of the network. But I think everyone approaches it differently. So do you have any like condensed advice that you would give for someone being like starting out from scratch, maybe just having their own professional network, but wanting to expand out?
There's so many different ways that can take form, right? And I would say, like, I would, maybe everyone has probably separate networks, right? Like there's what I'm going to say, you know, for me, my ex or Twitter network, right? Network of friends and professional folks who are all in the same situation for the most part. And we'll talk and I'll come back to that. You also have your professional network, especially what's going on LinkedIn. And, you know, I would say you treat this like a job, right? Like you have to keep those networks fresh. You have to keep them maintained. You got to keep keep in touch with folks. If you worked with someone a few years ago, you know, they could move on to a new job, a new position somewhere that you want to end up. And if you haven't spoken to them in 6 years, I'm not saying you can't, you know, reach out to them, but it's going to be a lot easier to get in somewhere, get a referral somewhere if you've been in contact with people for a certain amount of time. So that's another thing too to keep in mind, is like the quality of the network and how much time you're spending on it. I could spend a whole bunch of time on Twitter and probably get far less output than I would on LinkedIn. It's just part of the audience. It's part of the environment, right? So you want to make sure that you're working on that. On the kind of like the other aspect of it though, I this is not going to be for everyone. But networking it's an interesting thing. There's the personal aspect, which is, I think, what we were kind of talking about. But there's also this kind of the parasocial part of it that is also necessary, right? You don't want to just have a network that is just you and your friends. Those are great. That's great. You want that. But you're trying to go past that, right? So what you need is more than what you can personally manage. I can talk to a certain number of people per day, but that maxes out somewhere. That's not scalable, right? So in order for you to extend past what you can reach yourself, you have to have some value to provide to folks that they can kind of get incorporated into. So that's why I'll do things like, you know, I have my YouTube videos, I have open source projects, and anything I can do to kind of just get my name out there, but also provide value to folks, give people a reason to look me up or come back to what I'm doing, or just impress them again. Like I mentioned earlier, you don't even have to finish projects. I recommend making sure they, you know, they work and whatever, but every once in a while, I'll just post on LinkedIn one of my open source projects. It gets a few likes from people who haven't seen it before. Those people work in some companies and they're hiring, or, you know, they know someone who's hiring. So you're just getting in front of those people. And that's a kind of like non-contact network. I didn't have to talk to them directly. They were just within my sphere of influence and were able to see the types of things I'm working on. And those things hopefully were able to influence them in a way that had them either reach out to me or at least kept me in their brain when I reach out to them.
I think this is, I've been a very I guess, encouraging or a more hopeful conversation than I thought, which is great. Like, obviously, because I thought it was going to be like, you know, you got to go on the grind, make sure you do this, make sure you do that. But it just sounds like, you know, if you do have that runway or if you do have sort of that, you know, free time or a bit of freedom, that it's it really does give you perspective. But it also kind of, you know, like hearing you talk about all the opportunities and things you're thinking about, Kyle, shows that, you know, we as, I guess, tech experts, if you will, have like a lot of options, you know, on the table. Like, we're not just, it's not, you know, back way back in the day where it's like, well, I got laid off, I got to get the newspaper every day and check through the, you know, the classifieds and, you know, look for a job. It's like, oh, I'll try LinkedIn, I'll try this, maybe I'll try making a game, maybe I'll try, you know, you have all these different sort of avenues, and, you know, some might be dead ends, some might be, you know, you analyze it in your head and you think, whoa, you know, that's going to be too challenging or too whatever. But I mean, we have the opportunity to do that now, right? You know, you can make a game with just your computer, with just your laptop. You don't need to have, you know, a huge data center and, you know, only the office has internet. Like, we have internet at home now type thing. So like, there's just a lot of opportunity out there. And if you're open to it, it sounds like open to it and able to, again, have that runway, have that freedom. This is like a lot, bouncing back seems like it's a lot more hopeful now. now that we kind of had this conversation, because I just kind of figured it would be like, you know, the one part of the episode that would be a little more doom and gloom, but it really isn't. You know, it really doesn't sound like it is at all.
No, I think it's a really, like I said, it's a good time to figure out what you want to work on, but it gives you time to work on multiple things at once, right? Like I was saying, I'm applying to places, but I'm also working on, you know, the side gig. So if one works out, great. You know, if I'm doing the side gigs, and that can extend the amount of time that I have to get a, you know, a normal job, if that's what I want. That's a whole thing. I was actually looking at, you know, I'm not gonna say this is gonna work for everyone, but I was looking at, I, you know, might need to file for unemployment. Started talking to some of my ex coworkers, found out unemployment really doesn't pay anything at all. And then started doing a little bit more math. In fact, I figured out, like, if I just make one video for someone, I wouldn't even qualify for unemployment, you know? So you start doing a little bit of math, and it's like, I think I can do this. I think I can just, you know, try this out. And again, if it doesn't work, all of that effort that you put in is not for loss, right? Like, if in my situation, if I'm trying to create videos for people, what am I doing? Okay, well, I'm, you know, coding open source apps and making videos about them. That's going to get me hired too. That was it's all part of the same system. So it's great to have a little bit of free time to focus on you and your brand rather than building up someone else's company for a change for a little while.
Absolutely. And it's just to your benefit at the end of the day anyway, because if they see, you know, as a prospective employer, if they see that you've been putting effort into, especially if it's a like industry or a like project, they're going to be like, oh, if you're self-motivated, there's a classic HR term, right? If you're self-motivated and you're going to, you know, build up yourself, then, I mean, why not? Like, why wouldn't we want to, you know, at least bring you in for an interview?
Yeah, exactly. There's always luck involved. There's everything. But I think the best way for you to potentially get a job is through this pipeline, right? Do something cool. Someone somewhere sees it and is impressed, whether that's LinkedIn or Twitter. They say, we want what you're doing at our company. And they are more like, not only more, you're getting through the interview process, you're not going through any of that automated nonsense that can cut you out. They want you, so you have a better bargaining position and you can likely get what you want. So, you know, there's different ways to spend your time. And I think improving on you, your brand, and yourself is always going to be a good option.
Absolutely. So with that being said, you know, just to sort of capstone the episode, I kind of wanted to talk about something fun. And this also kind of ties into building your own brand or trying something new or whatever. And I've seen on your YouTube channel, because I watched your Plex server video years ago. And just before the show here, you were talking about a payphone project that you were doing. And there's been a bunch of hardware is basically what I'm getting at, that I've seen you work with and people that exist in web development or just software in general, really just kind of see the things that they make appear on a screen, right? They don't see the physical lights, button, like lights going off. They don't see switches changing states or whatever. So I'd like for you to, like, kind of, you know, maybe explore that a little bit with me and you know, tell me a little bit about your hardware software projects and how far have you gotten into hardware? Like, are you writing your own core files and drivers and those type of things? Or are you just using Arduinos? Like, you know, what do you think about that?
I wish. Yeah, I love to talk about it though. But yeah, no, I haven't, not any drivers or anything like that. But it's fun, you know. I like to tinker. It's not about you know, any particular technology. It's just technology, right? So if you can pass me some technology, I'm super into it. Arduino is really cool. For the folks who are listening and don't know, And Arduino is what they call a microprocessor or a dev board. There's lots of little different names for it, but it's essentially like a very cheap little, it's not a computer. It's just a processor. It does not run an operating system. And you can run C code on it for the most part. And with that C code, you can just like put power in one direction or cut power in one direction, right? But that'll let you do all types of fun things. When 3D printers were taking off, like right before they really got popular, that was all done by like the folks who were tinkering with Arduino and stuff, right? If you're familiar with 3D printers, or if you're not familiar with 3D printers, it's just a bunch of like brushless motors and fans and things on a track. And what you can do is you can use an Arduino to just provide power to some wire, and that turns a motor for a certain amount of time. I'm oversimplifying a little bit. You actually do this digitally, but there you go. You have a 3D printer, right?
Right.
So it's very, very cool stuff. It's very fun to play with. We were saying before this meeting, I don't play with it as much as I wish I did, because I'll tell you, folks who are doing the software stuff, 99% of hardware is going to be software anyway. It's just a different interface. So it's a lot of times like making something into a smart something, but honestly, it just ends up being like adding notifications to something. So it's fun. It's rare that I have an innovative project, but if you're interested, I could tell you a little bit more about the payphone situation.
Of course, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that was one of the only hardware projects that I've had of recent memory that was actually interesting, and it can also be done fully in software. In fact, it is on my GitHub if anyone's interested. But what happened was about a year ago or so, I went on eBay and I bought myself a payphone. I really wanted a payphone. I wanted it in general. I was like, they're disappearing. I'm like a digital archivist. I really like, I collect digital files that I think might be in danger and stuff like that. And somehow the payphone felt like that to me. It was like, hey, I should get a payphone before they disappear. Xbox 360 is on my list if anyone's throwing those out. So you got to get yourself some old hardware. But I had an idea. This was like right about the time that ChatGPT came out, not too long after. AI voice was becoming a thing as well. So it was kind of interesting where we had ChatGPT and we had AI voices, but they weren't connected in any way. So I came up with this idea where I had a thought where you could ask ChatGPT to pretend to be someone and then respond as if they were that person. So you could say, you know, write me a poem in the style of this poet or so on and so forth. And I eventually thought to myself, like, you know, we all had, what was like the first thing y'all did with AI, right? Like that you ask it some kind of interesting question, right? Just try to see how like human or smart it is or anything like that. One of the first things I asked, I was like, man, if I could ask Albert Einstein, like what he thinks about, you know, certain, you know, scientific theories of today, I'm not going to go too deep into that. He was not a fan of quantum mechanics, for instance, but I'd be curious to see, like, oh, I want to talk to him today. And of course you can't really do that, but ChatGPT can fake it. It can use a lot of his mannerisms and stuff. I was like, this is pretty cool. Let's connect it to a voice so that I can type and then he can talk back. And we'll take it a little bit further. Let's connect my voice to it so I can talk to it and then it can talk back. Now ChatGPT can actually take your voice in, but it didn't do that at the time. So I started writing a little API, some REST API in Node. I don't even remember what framework or anything like that, but wrote the little REST API, and you can tell it who you want to speak to, and then you can send it an audio file of your voice. And what it will do is convert it to text, send the text off to ChatGPT with a little prompt that says, you know, pretend to be this person and answer this question as if you're on the telephone. And then ChatGPT will respond and convert it back to voice. So I have that whole API. It's on my GitHub. And then what I was going to do, but I haven't actually completed, was connect that to my payphone. So I bought the payphone, got a Raspberry Pi, pulled out all of the guts of the payphone, had all those old motherboards in it and things like that. Most of that, I had no idea what that stuff was doing, and you couldn't really find anything online. And I was thinking to myself, how am I going to hack into this payphone? Like, how do I use the hardware of this payphone? Eventually I realized you just don't use any of the hardware of the payphone. You just rip out all the internals and replace it with a Raspberry Pi and just very thinly veiled, connect it to like the actual handset of the phone and the keypad and stuff. You look at this giant payphone and you realize like in today's technology, what needs to be inside would be hilariously small. It would all fit inside the handset of the payphone for sure. I got as far as right now. In fact, I think it might still be plugged in. The keypad to the payphone is now connected to the Raspberry Pi with Python, and you can press numbers on the keypad and they'll show up. And I even had a little dictionary of like quote unquote phone numbers that you could call. So if like, if you typed in 00 pound, for instance, that was going to be my operator. It will then trigger a function when it registers that. So
right.
The next step, if I ever get into it, is to actually connect it to the handset so that you can actually record your voice. That was a little bit more complicated, but not that complicated. Still super doable.
I think you should just do it, because to be honest, yeah. I just want to see it. I want to see this thing working. And that just sounds awesome.
I appreciate it. I need to. I thought too, I would love to, because I live in Philly. It'd be kind of cool if maybe I could, if I ever finish it, it'd be kind of expensive because of the whole API usage stuff. But if I ever finish it, I would love to like just have it in a museum for a day or two, just to like see how the public, like who are they talking to? What are they asking? You know, I would just want to see how people, you give people, here's a payphone that lets you speak to anyone in history. I want to see how people use it.
Yeah. I mean, it would be, I can already see like a really like gussied up YouTube video where like someone has like cinematographed the whole thing and like a themed set or something. Like it'd be pretty cool. It'd be pretty cool for sure.
I got to do it. We were talking earlier when we were before the show started, it's just all, you know, filming and soldering at the same time and all that kind of stuff. It's rough, but I have the time now. Right. So I might have to give it another shot.
For sure. For sure. Well, the reason why I wanted to ask too, just is because Mike and I went to when we were in college, we had quite a few embedded courses, maybe two or three embedded courses. And we actually did end up writing our own core files and drivers to an extent. So the teacher basically gave us the core files because there were so many functions of the chip, but there was a hole in it. And he's like, okay, like just so you get experience writing a core file, like make the general input output system, just like this one function type thing, just so we know like what a core file is, what a driver effectively is. And that's what we were doing. But the one problem with that is like, all we're seeing is lights turn off and on and like things like that. It's like really basic, but seeing like a, you know, a payphone that dials in, it's like, oh, okay. You know, the buttons get, you know, the sort of like wheels start turning in your head, like, okay, so like the LEDs are actually the buttons and yada, yada, yada. And you start marrying hardware and software together once you start seeing like an actual true project sort of presented like that.
Yeah. It's really fun to get instant feedback. You know, I tell people kind of like for the same reason when people ask, I need a project for coding, what should I work on? It's like, you know, obviously it depends on what you're trying to do, but I always tell people you should make a video game. And the reason I say that is because that's a very open-ended suggestion. Like, what is a video game, right? It's like, it could be something in the terminal. It could be something in the web browser. It could be Unity. It could be Unreal. It could be whatever. It could be 3D. It could be 2D. It could be text-based. It doesn't really matter. The point is you're coding and it's a game. And the other major thing is you get the instant feedback, right? So like if it's a video game, you press spacebar, it jumps, you press right, it moves forward, you do whatever, right? That's not always the case when you're writing like a web app or something like that. It's not so much that interactive feedback that like helps you immediately see what's going on. But that's the same thing with like electronics too. You get yourself a breadboard, you give it some power, you get yourself an LED and a potentiometer, you start turning it and you see the LED you know, going up and down in brightness, you get that immediate feedback. It's much easier to like understand what's happening and learn from there. So it does get a little bit more complicated when you start getting into like, you know, the digital stuff and Wi-Fi and all that. But
yeah,
for sure. I really enjoy the direct feedback.
Absolutely. It's like, it's tactile too. You know, it's like in your hands and you're actually seeing like, whoa, like my circuit's doing this. And it's like almost invisible, and it's, you know, in its circuitry, like you're not literally seeing like a lightning bolt come out of the potentiometer or something like that.
Well, hopefully not.
Hopefully not. Yeah. We've had many a fire in the computer lab. Mike and I have seen many a fire, many a smoke, and one that smoked out the entire class because it was so the area or the hydro company, utility company here is Hydro One for Ontario, and they made a lab, and like we're computer people, so we usually deal with like 5 volts, maybe 12. And so we had to have a course, of course, in this Hydro One lab. We're working with 120 AC or 240. I think it might have even been AC. And yeah, full fire.
Yeah.
Full no fire. Doubt. Like not. It's like, man, don't like we're supposed to be on DC and we're supposed to be 5 to 12 volts. Probably shouldn't even be touching the 12. We probably shouldn't be in this lab.
That's how I feel about high voltage. People say like, don't you know about electronics? I'm like, no, I know 5 volts. There's no bad things that can happen. I remember this isn't nearly as exciting, but I remember I was so proud of something I made with like a breadboard and I think one of those those like quarter sized Arduinos. And I don't even remember what it was, but I take a, this is years ago now. So I take out Snapchat and recording. I'm like, look, I'm going to do this. And then blue smoke just everywhere. I'm like, oh, I don't even know what I did.
Magic smoke coming out. That's it.
I was looking at the camera, not the whatever. I don't know what I touched.
Classic. I think ours was purple smoke, if I remember correctly, in the Hydro One lab. Not sure what happened there. Luckily, it wasn't my station. That's all I remember. Like, well, that guy's not getting 10 out of 10. You know? That's all you care about as a student, right? So,
absolutely hilarious. I got to get myself, you know, I don't know about y'all, but we've had like a really dry season. I'm looking to see if I have one. I need one of those static wristbands. I actually have my computer's mostly disassembled over here. I'm talking to you on my Mac. I'm basically scared to touch it right now. We have this dry weather in the winter. I'm basically static shock. Every time I'm standing up right now, but if I touch this chair and then get out of this chair, I will deliver an extremely high voltage to anyone who comes in contact with me.
You gotta get like something like attached to your desk. You just always touch it. That's what I do when I work on a computer. I have like a thing and I always touch to try to sort of discharge myself.
Every time I leave this room, I have the like, okay, I got to grab the doorknob real quickly and just
get it over with real quick. Yeah.
Yep. There's that point where I'm like, it's gotta be these headphones charging me or something. This can't be normal.
Well, thank you very much, Kyle, for all your insights in this episode. It was a great interview, and I hope you enjoyed it as well. But at this time, I'd like to give you the floor to plug anything you'd like, your website, YouTube channel, and whatever else. The floor is yours.
I appreciate that. It's been super fun. Love what y'all are doing here, and just can't wait to listen to some more episodes right after this. I'm going to get right into it. But as you all know, my name is Kyle, TechSquid TV. TechSquidTV.com has everything of mine on there. My GitHub, my YouTube, my LinkedIn, anything you could want to see on there. I have some cool blog posts. I recommend checking them out.
Awesome. And we will be linking to those on HTMLallthethings.com inside of the show notes if you, the listener, are willing and able, and you definitely should go check out those links.
Thank you very much.
Well, I hope that you enjoyed that interview as much as we did, but it is time to end. And before we end, we'd like to thank our $3 tier patrons. And remember that if you would like to support episodes like this, you can do so by going to patreon.com/HTML all the things. And again, many thanks to our $3 tier patrons, Tim from The Web Hacker on thewebhacker.com, Jason from Geek Life Radio via geekliferadio.com, Fire Ant Season via fireantseason.com, Garrett Segal, Level Up Financial Planning via www.levelupfinancialplanning.com, and Joshua via silvio.us. Also remember that we do have a Scrimba affiliate link. If you want to learn on an interactive media player code editor, go check out their free courses, go check out their subscriptions, go and just generally check out what they have to offer. There's a lot of great instructors there, a lot of great learning potential there. Go and check that out. That link will be in the show description as well as in the show notes on htmlallthethings.com. And last but not least, we'd like to give a shout out to a contributing author on htmlallthethings.com. That it would be Michael LaRocca. He is the author of the Self-Taught The X Generation blog at selftauttxg.com. Feel free to leave a comment or a review on the platform that you are listening to this on, and this outro will sign us off.
You've been listening to HTML All the Things podcast. Web development, web design, and small business. We hope you've gotten some useful and practical information from this show. And we hope you appreciate that we talk to you like human beings. And we hope you had some fun. We'll be back soon. But in the meantime, hit us up on social media. On Facebook, Instagram, and Patreon at HTML All the Things. And on Twitter at HTML Everything. Until next time, this is HTML All the Things. Signing off.